This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk.
One of the words they use a lot in the testimonials is, I was a bit sceptical to begin with. And then I think they hear the things that we can tell them, our own, sorry, crap phrase, but isn't it? But our lived experiences, what's happened to us and what a difference it has made to us as individual coaches, as we all have our ordinary lives as well. So, oh yeah, as the people have their kind of beliefs, the truths, the things that they hold to be true about alcohol, and we just gradually work through them. So the big one, obviously, with the blue light services is it helps me unwind and relax after a tough shift. And then you just go through, literally, through the biochemistry. What happens in the body when you drink alcohol? So it can't. It does. It feels like it relieves stress for 20 to 30 minutes. But after that, everything that happens in the body once the alcohol is in the bloodstream is doing the very opposite of that.
Tabin Almond is this week's guest on Over the Influence. Tabin is coming up for 7 years alcohol-free. She talks about so much stuff in this episode. Oh, my goodness me. We literally did run out of time. Tabin shares her really personal breast cancer journey with us, the link with alcohol as well. She talks about her work with the blue light experiment, which has just ended. It ran through the month of January and everything else in between. So let's get into this week's episode.
Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
I'm Aaron and I live in Bonnie, Scotland. My life used to revolve around alcohol. I went to the local pub every night. All of my friends drank, and I couldn't imagine a life without booze. Slowly but surely, time took its toll, and I got tired of this life. Sober curious, I took a leap and joined OTI. How my life has changed. I'm now a year and a half sober and loving every minute of it. For me, OTI is a place where we can celebrate the joys of alcohol-free life without any judgment. The most amazing connections and friendships have been made through this community. Come join us and have a good laugh at the same time.
You've heard the podcast. Now join the conversation. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Welcome to this week's episode of Over the Influence. We say it every single week, but we genuinely mean it. Thank you for being here. It is great to have you listening. If you have just maybe bagged your first dry month for a very, very long time, you'll be listening to this in February. Really, really well done. And if you're still going, maybe 6 weeks in, heading towards your seventh week, your second month, why don't you consider going for 100 days? Because we say, don't we, Ben, here at Over the Influence, that is the tipping point when you hit triple figures. Quick, I say introduction, reintroduction. Anyway, just to let you know who we are, my name is Sharon Hartley, based in Lancashire in the northwest of England. 51 years old, although at the moment I feel about 107. However, this year I will be 7 years alcohol free. And it's just the way it is now. It's amazing. It's so good. Never thought I would be here, to be honest with you. Never wanted to be here as a drinker. And even in those early days when I took that first break from booze, that first extended break from booze back in 2018, that was all it was ever going to be. Anyway, I stuck with it. And it's just, risk of sounding corny, Ben, don't laugh. It's the life-changing magic of quitting alcohol. It really is. And it is. Oh, he literally just raised his eyes then. He just raised his eyes. But it's true. Honestly, it is so, so true. It's not just me wanging on about sobriety. No, I do it with Ben. How are you doing, Ben Anderson?
Fine, thanks. Hello. Ben, 36, live in Liverpool. I am dad to Leo, stepdad to Alfie and Millie, husband to Jem. I've raised my eyebrows because, if you don't know, The Life-Changing Magic of Quitting Alcohol is the title of Sharon's book. In fact, I'm on a call today with two authors. Our guest is an author too, which is all very exciting. But yeah, I'm 4.5 years alcohol-free. I had an interesting lunch today, Sharon, where it was a work lunch.
Right.
And I started to talk about Over the Influence.
Okay.
And the response was from this person, and I couldn't believe it. Oh, you're an Elkie then?
And oh, you know what? Man alive.
And you know what? 4.5 years ago, I think I would have panicked. And I would have kind of, I'm really sorry. I would have kind of blustered my way through my response. I very calmly said, actually, let's say his name's Dave. Actually, no, Dave, you know what? I didn't even mean to. I gave up alcohol for 3 months for a break. Then I got to 3 and thought, you know what? This feels good. I'm going to do 6. Got to 6 and thought, this feels great. I'm going to do 12. Got to day 366 and thought, can't deny it. This is better for me. It's a good choice for me, Dave, being alcohol free. But I just, you know, we talk about how far society's come on this podcast since we removed alcohol all those years ago.
Yeah.
And then you have those moments like that where you go, oh, come on. Come on.
And you know what, though? What if you'd have turned round and said to Dave, in inverted commas, yes, I am an alky.
Well.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It gets my goat.
Well, for me, I wasn't. I drank in my 20s because it was fun. I drank in my 30s because I was stressed. And I definitely knew that was my drinking was going the wrong way. And I certainly could have got myself to a point where I was continuing to go down that slippery slope.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I removed alcohol and everything improved pretty dramatically, pretty quickly, actually. But now I think I've got that 4.5 years alcohol-free confidence. Anyway, I just thought it just popped. I was just like, I thought, I can't wait to tell Shaz that tonight.
I'm glad I wasn't there and I jumped on him.
Are you okay, by the way? Because are you going to introduce our other author?
Yes, I am.
What a highbrow podcast we have today.
Very highbrow. And, you know, because I'm an author, I'm going to talk like this for the entire episode.
Yes, of course.
Absolutely not. Enough of us wanging on. That was a really, really long introduction. Thank you so much to this week's guest waiting patiently on this call. She's called Tabin Almond. You have got the best name, Tabin. Just absolutely love your name.
Oh, thank you. I made it up myself.
Oh.
I literally did. I couldn't say Catherine, and I said Tabin,
oh, I love
and it just
that.
Stuck. And I'd always thought, you know, it's just a childish name and stuff. And then when I finally got alcohol free doing This Naked Mind with Annie Grace, and I was on a course of very few people, very early days of This Naked Mind, and Annie was coaching the course herself, which is kind of good. And she said, oh, that's an unusual name. And I said, oh, I made it up. And she said, oh, I love that. You named yourself. And I thought, and she said, how empowering. And I thought, yeah, I named myself. That's much better than I made it up because I was too pathetic. I couldn't even say Catherine.
Tabin Almond, based in Devon, it is lovely to have you on Over the Influence. Thank you so much for your time. If I've got my figures right, like me, you're approaching 7 years alcohol-free.
I am, yeah.
Before we get into all that, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, well, I grew up in a boozy environment. My parents both drank. I guess, you know, you could say that my mum was an alcoholic. I don't like using that word like you, Ben. It feels like offensive and stigmatizing to me, but she certainly had a problem with alcohol, which I didn't understand at the time. And I used to get very cross about as a teenager and vowed that I wouldn't become like her. And then, cut to a few years later, I'm doing exactly the same thing. All the adults in our childhood drank. Not all problematically, but alcohol was omnipresent at the time. My dad was a farmer and he would come in from, you know, doing the animals and kick his wellies off. Oh, I need a drink. So I grew up believing that alcohol was how adults relaxed and had a good time. So I started doing that. And, you know, in a rural village in Devon, you know, we were in the pub from the age of about 16. If whoever was supposed to be driving back was over the limit, the landlord would phone one of our parents and they would come and get us, which was usually somebody else's parents rather than mine, to be honest. But, you know, it was a very sort of safe environment from that point of view. Went off to uni and I was already by then quite enthusiastic social drinker. And I studied French. And when you study French, you have a year in France. And it's pretty random where you get sent. And I got given the town of Cognac. of all places. So that was like, it felt like, oh, lucky old me. And I started working. I worked in a school during the academic year and then got a job working for one of the cognac houses, went back out there after I'd graduated. And then I got a job in advertising, which seemed brilliant because it was so boozy. Advertising in the 1980s, because I'm quite old, was just so boozy. And I was on the media planning side, which meant that the media owners, like the newspapers and magazines and radio stations, etc., they all wanted me as their client. So they would take me out for lunch. And those lunches always involved a lot of booze. And we're talking like a gin and tonic before, wine with the meal, you know, sometimes, you know, glass of port or Sambuca. We drank an awful lot of Sambuca back in the day. Yeah. And then did that stupid thing with those amarettis where you set fire to the paper. And it was just, yeah, I don't know what we thought we were doing, but we drank an awful lot. And that was at lunchtime. And then in the evening, you'd go to the pub. So, but because everybody around me did that, I kind of thought it was normal. And of course, when I went home to my parents at the weekend, which I did from time to time, there was plenty of booze. So it was, I was never really not drinking. I'd got married, and the first time for ever since I was in my teens, really, that I didn't drink for any prolonged period of time was when I was pregnant. And that was fine. So I'd had these occasional thoughts of maybe I drink too much, but then I was able to stop really, really easily when I was pregnant. So I thought, this is no problem. And it wasn't really until we moved to Devon, which is, we were living in London, and my husband and I moved to Devon with two small children. He was working away a lot, and I was at home with the children, and I wasn't working and having all these boozy lunches. I was at home working freelance. So it was a very different sort of setup. And I'd get the kids into bed and then just come downstairs. John would be away. I'd just open a bottle of wine and drink it. And doing that on a daily basis, I gradually started to realise that this was kind of unhealthy and I wasn't feeling great. And there's something sort of sad and a bit shameful, it felt to me, about drinking on my own so much. So I started trying to find out about things. And I'm a bit of a thinker and a researcher by bent, I suppose. So I started trying to find out about things. And there wasn't a lot of Quitlet about at the time. We're talking the very early 2000s. And I remember going to the States. We were on holiday and I went to a Barnes & Noble in New York. And there was this whole section about alcohol. I bought 5 or 6 books and read them all and tried lots of times with willpower. Thought, right, I've learned all this stuff about what alcohol's doing. So just don't do it. Don't do it. And that would work for a bit and then it wouldn't. And I can see you nodding. There's that sort of self-loathing that builds up and you start beating yourself up. That's what I was doing.
The reason we're both nodding, we talk about that all the time. You know, that kind of, Sharon, your phrase is not clinging on, white knuckling it.
Yeah,
you talk about with willpower, isn't it? And we're very keen on talking about how when you remove alcohol from your life, you're not stopping something, you're actually starting something. And yeah. I think that kind of, that very slight reframing, because it's not a major,
it's just
a change of language, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not stopping drinking, I'm starting living differently. And that's so powerful.
And, when I'm coaching, I say to people, it's not, if you can switch it from thinking about giving up to what do I want more of in my life, and just focusing on that, then alcohol kind of fades away. But I didn't have any of that knowledge or insight at the time. I went to AA for a couple of years because it's literally all I knew about. I didn't feel like I fitted in there. And people talk about finding your tribe and stuff. And I don't know if it was just the groups I went to. I mean, Devon's not a high crime area, really, but it seemed like everybody in these groups had been in prison, and it was very male and really big on the shame and the you're only one day away from disaster kind of feeling. It didn't feel very optimistic or hopeful. And I also was, and I think this is probably my fault, but I was made to feel that I hadn't reached enough of a rock bottom. if that makes sense. You haven't got any criminal convictions. You haven't even been done for drink driving. What are you whinging about, girl? Kind of was the vibe I got. Nobody ever said that, but it was just, that was my take out, I think. And I had a lovely lady who, in one group, who was my sort of would-be sponsor. And she kept saying to me, but Tabin, you're in denial. And I was going, I'm not, because I'm here. Clearly not in denial. I know this, that I've got a problem. But I couldn't really bring myself, this whole thing of, hello, my name's Tabin, I'm an alcoholic. And for me, I didn't really know what an alcoholic was. I thought it was somebody who lost everything and was on a park bench. And I wasn't there. And I just felt really uncomfortable and very, I didn't like the labeling, and I just felt it was very miserable and depressing. And also the whole thing about we are powerless. And I thought, I don't think I am. I'm actually quite a strong, independent woman. I think I can regain my power somehow. I'm not quite sure how. So I stuck it out for about 2 years, and I tried three different groups, and I kept just thinking, this isn't right. Then I read Alan Carr's book, The Easy Way to Control Alcohol. And the words easy and control just like leapt out at me. And I thought, oh, yeah, I'll have a bit of that. And I read it. And it was the first time I'd read anything where it was talking about the role of the subconscious, which kind of made a lot of sense. Because everybody who's ever been in a pickle with alcohol, we know that there's that subconscious drive to drink. And then we've got the conscious bit of our brain saying, nah, you know, that's a bad idea. But I just, and it was the first time that I'd really encountered that. And it made so much sense. And I did a hypnotherapy course at his clinic in London. And that was it. I was fine. I didn't even think about alcohol for 7.5 years. And I honestly thought at that point, I'll never drink again. It seemed to have just been the magic cure. And I recommend it to anybody who ever said to me, oh, how did you do? Oh, it's easy peasy. Just, you know, slap a load of money down on the table for Alan Carr and jobs are good. You know, I really believe that. And during that period, my marriage was really deteriorating. And a long story, which I won't go into here, but we finally split up in 2013. And 3 months later, so around between Christmas and New Year, I had this really weird thing where I'd had a lump in my breast for a few years, and I had been to the doctor, and this, we don't think it's anything to worry about, but we'll just give you regular mammograms just to be sure. And so I was having these mammograms really, really regularly, like every 6 months. And just before Christmas, I got the results, and it was a letter, you know, dear Mrs. Armand, happy to report, nothing to worry about. Oh, that's good. And then I woke up one night between Christmas and New Year, and I can remember it so clearly. And it was like a really deep, strong gut feeling. And it was the same feeling that had led me to understand what was going wrong in the marriage. And this feeling just said, that letter's wrong. There is something the matter. And just because I'd been right the last time, the only other time I'd felt that so strongly, I thought, I better not ignore this. So I went to the doctor and living in a little village, you know, I knew my doctor, and I said, look, you're going to think I'm mad, but I think that there is something wrong. I don't think that this is just a benign cyst. And he said, well, you've just had the mammogram, but mammograms aren't foolproof. Let's just get you back in the hospital and we'll get it checked. And sure enough, it was a tumor. It was a whopper. It was just over 5 centimeters. And that, you know, with the guy who did the ultrasound scan, when I asked him what he could see, he, having been quite patronizing and saying, oh, let's, you know, let's just put your little mind at rest sort of thing, just said, what I can see is a woman with potentially life-saving instincts. I'm really glad you're here. And we need to get a move on. And I didn't even drink through all of that. I'd gone to the hospital thinking they were just going to do some tests and I'd find out in a week or two. And there I was finding out that I had pretty big tumour in there, and they needed to get on with things. And they did all these biopsies and stuff and said, come back in a few days and we'll have the results for you. And I was on my own. Marriage just fallen apart. well, you know, finances in dire state. And I still didn't even think about drinking. And that I had, went into hospital, had the initial surgery. And in, during that, they tested my lymph nodes. And I went back and they said, right, the good news is you've healed really well from the surgery. But the bad news is we tested 7 lymph nodes and the cancer was in all 7 and in a really high count. We need to find out where it's spread to. And at that point, I don't know if that's actually what they said. That's certainly what I heard. And I was just terrified. I just had this vision that I was going to die. And I wasn't actually frightened of me dying, but I was really frightened of leaving my children with only their dad, who was A, in Australia, and B, not at all well. And I just was freaked out by it. And I went home that night and I was with my brother and daughter, who was an adult by then. She was like 21. And they opened a bottle of wine and I just said, I think I'll have some. And I hadn't drunk. And that thought had not even crossed my mind for 7.5 years. And straight back into it. I drank at least a bottle of wine that night. And it was purely out of, I do not want to be in my head right now. And felt utterly dreadful the next day. And I was then in hospital having MRI scans and all that sort of stuff. And an MRI scan when you've got the mother and father of all hangovers is definitely not to be recommended. Just like in this tube that's really noisy and claustrophobic. And you think, oh my God, I'm going to be sick and my head's splitting. That was it. I was back. It was like the genie was out of the bottle. And I didn't drink that much straight away because I was back in hospital. I had 2 more operations and then very quickly into the chemo and the radiotherapy, and it drags on and you just don't feel very well. And alcohol, I kind of, although nobody said anything, but I kind of figured that alcohol was not going to aid my recovery from cancer and, you know, recovering from operations and stuff. But once I was better, I can remember very clearly asking the consultant when I was sort of, you know, okay, you've finished everything. And I said, is there anything, what can I do to stay cancer free? And they didn't say anything about alcohol. I went home and drank Prosecco with a friend who'd taken me for my final treatment to celebrate the end of my treatment for breast cancer, completely unaware that alcohol causes breast cancer. It's not the only cause, but it's a principal cause, particularly of estrogen receptor breast cancer, which is what I had. Nobody said anything, literally. And I asked point blank and they still didn't volunteer the information. And I've since tackled that consultant. And she said, well, you know, we don't like to shame people. And I said, well, A, I don't think there's any shame involved. But secondly, I'd rather know than not know. It would have been helpful to have been told, you've had a disease which we know is contributed to by alcohol, if not directly caused by, might be a good idea not to go back to it. But then nobody said anything.
So did you make that link yourself, Tabin? Is that what you're saying? Or
eventually, yeah, I learned it. I had another sort of 3 years probably from then. Yeah, 3 years where I was drinking, struggling. And then I eventually discovered This Naked Mind, which is how I got alcohol free. And it was when I did a course with Annie Grace and learned that one of the health risks associated with alcohol is cancer, specifically breast cancer and 5 others. I thought, and I just remember thinking, what? I actually asked point blank. And then I thought, maybe they didn't know that back in 2014 when I asked the question, to find that it had been known for decades. It's been on the World Health Organization website for a long time, but they just don't share this information. And that makes me really cross, really cross.
And finding that out, which is so incredibly serious and so incredibly important. Mm. At what point did you stop drinking? again, because you know, as I mentioned in the intro, Tabin, you're now, you know, approaching seven years alcohol free, yeah, and you'd already done a stint of 7 and a bit years, and as you're talking about now, return to it. When was the penny drop moment where you went, hang on, no more?
Yeah, I read this Naked Mind in the spring of 2018, and I thought, oh my God, this makes so much sense. And I signed up to do a 3-month course. Very early on in that course, I learned about breast cancer being caused by alcohol.
And so by this point, sorry to interrupt you, but I'm just trying to give time scales and make it clear. The cancer was 2014.
14,
so had you finished all your treatment then?
Yeah. I finished all my treatment by the end of 2014. Yeah. And then I'd 2015, 16, 17, I was drinking increasingly secretly and problematically and hating myself. Found this Naked Mind. I did that Googling, am I an alcoholic thing. Came across this Naked Mind, started getting emails from them and read the book and then quickly signed up for a course. And that's when I learned about the connection between breast cancer and alcohol. And as it happened, I was also I'd signed up to do the moonwalk for breast cancer charities in the May of that year. And I'd signed up and organised a group. There were 8 of us doing it. Who'd all been touched by breast cancer in some way, you know, mothers and daughters and that sort of stuff. And at the time when I did that, I had no idea about the alcohol connection. And then I was literally the night before we were going to do it, I was with my daughter in a restaurant in Finsbury Park, and we'd gone out for pizza or something to eat. I can't remember what the food was, but I do remember having a glass of white wine. And I remember the wine. No, I remember it was a Pinot Grigio. And I drank a little bit of it. And I just thought, this is just nuts. I'm really lucky to have survived breast cancer. I mean, it was a whopping great tumour. It was about to spread all around my body and they caught it in time. And I've now learned that this disease, particularly the type that I had, is caused by alcohol. Not the only cause, but a significant cause. I'm about to do this walk to raise money for charity, a charity that helps people. I've got this knowledge. What on earth am I doing drinking alcohol now? And I just thought, I'm done. I don't want it anymore. And I can remember I passed my glass across the table to Lucy, my daughter, and said, do you want this? And she went, oh, is it not very nice? And I went, It's fine. I just don't want it. And she said, oh, it's not like you. And I said, I think I'm just done with wine. And she went, just wine or everything? And I think everything. I'm not going to say never, but I just can't see why I would carry on doing this to myself. And that was it, 12th of May 2018. And I haven't drunk since. And nor have I wanted to, which is the real joy. Yeah. And that not wanting to just grows stronger. But yeah, that was the breast cancer is a really big factor for me in giving up something that was just harmful.
We've got a mutual friend, Tabin, who's actually watching this call.
We have. Annie. Hello, Annie.
So we know Annie. Annie joined our community a few years back. I mean, ages. It feels like we've known Annie forever. We love Annie. She's fabulous. Yeah, I'm not just saying that because she's listening and on this call.
It's true. She is fabulous.
I say that behind her back as well.
We do.
But you're working with Annie, aren't you? Because you're now working with the NHS as part of the blue light experiment.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think that's fascinating. You've had this experience. You felt aggrieved that actually you asked for some information and you didn't get it. You're now working directly with medical professionals. Can you tell us about that?
So this whole initiative came about through a lady called Maria Fox, who was she's just retired, like literally in the last couple of months. She was a very senior police officer. I'll get her rank wrong if I say it. Chief superintendent or constable or something. Anyway, I'll get it wrong because I don't know much about the police.
Yeah.
Very important, very senior. She had her own journey with alcohol and is also a trained coach. And she is a very persuasive lady. She realised that there's a real problem in the police force where a lot of police officers are drinking to relieve stress at the end of a shift. It's one of the jobs we give alcohol to do, isn't it? Stress reliever. And so she wanted to do something
about it. Love that, by the way, Tabin. That's one of the things that we give alcohol, not that alcohol gives us. You're absolutely right there. Again, just that,
we
that
give it use jobs, of language don't we?
There. Yeah, love that.
So Maria, who's very persuasive, as Annie will testify, got a bunch of coaches to give up their time and run. There's a thing called the alcohol experiment that Annie Grace and This Naked Mind have. And the first year we used Annie Grace's videos, the video a day for 30 days, 31 days. And we ran them. And every day we did a coaching session around that video. And we had a reasonable number, a couple of hundred or something, police officers join. And part of the feedback was, this is great, but can we have English people doing the videos? They liked the English coaches and it was a bit jarring to have all American videos. And we'd thought, actually, let's bring in a few more people. So we brought in Annie's husband, Charlie, to give us a really strong medical perspective. We brought in William Porter, who was particularly good on the hot, well, he's good on everything, but particularly on sleep. So we just expanded it a little bit and we made a whole series of videos ourselves where we went into a bit more detail and we could angle it a bit more towards people in stressful blue light jobs. So we expanded it from just the police to NHS and fire and ambulance. We had a lot of ambulance dispatchers as well. We did that last year. We've just literally, we're in the first week of February now. We've just repeated it again for the third year. And some amazing testimonials. And I love reading them because there are people who say, well, I thought I'd do it just because I was thinking about doing Dry January and I thought this might help. And it's made me realise that how harmful alcohol is and what a grip it had on me. So people who were saying, oh, I might do Dry January, are now sort of carrying on. And we've got people in the group who came back again this year who hadn't drunk since last January and who's sort of saying, here are my before and after photos. I've lost all this weight. I've run marathons. I've done this. I've done that. I've gone for a promotion. And people's lives just taking off. Relationships improved. All sorts of, well, we know that all the benefits. So it's, and it's something I'm kind of quite passionate about because I really have a concern about workplace cultures encouraging us to drink. And I think there are two. There's the very stressful jobs like the blue light services where people tend, and often they don't want to take the what's been going on at work home with them. Often they can't, you know, they can't talk about patients or people they've arrested or whatever. It's all confidential. And so they decompress kind of with their colleagues and over a beer or two or three. And it becomes, the alcohol becomes associated with the decompression. And it's not actually, it's just an adjunct. It's being with other people and being able to talk that's doing the good, not the booze. But we lose sight of that. And so I think helping people to understand that alcohol has no role in stress reduction, actually, it makes it worse because it triggers the adrenal gland. It floods our body with adrenaline and cortisol. That's not stress reduction. That's stress worsening. You know, it's like, and then there's also jobs like what I did in advertising where, don't get me wrong, I loved it. But if I had ever said, actually, I don't want to drink. I don't want to take these clients out. It was like, that's part of your job. You take them out. You show them a good time. You don't make them feel embarrassed. If they want to drink, you drink with them. That was never a problem for me while I was working in London, but it's not right. And all those sort of like little things where, I don't know, your boss is, you know, come on, it's Thursday night, everybody over the pub, I'm buying sort of thing. If somebody's already struggling, that's not really helpful. And all those sort of advertising agency Christmas parties, just something else.
Don't get me started on this, Tabin. I like alcohol in certain situations. When you, I always talk about how when you've been alcohol free for a while, it's like you've unplugged yourself from the matrix and you look in at these kind of social norms and you just realize how bonkers they are. For me, alcohol and work, it's like the least compatible, because that bossy says, right, come on, let's get across the road, it's Thursday night. They expect you to still be there in the morning on time and ready to work. Do you know what I mean? I just find the whole drinking culture within work just completely and utterly nuts, because they don't fit. It's like exactly. Christmas parties. You come to the Christmas party and you drink the perfect amount. You drink enough so that you're involved, but you don't drink too much that you can't turn up tomorrow and do your job properly. But the perfect amount, don't embarrass us by drinking too much and becoming out of control.
Yeah.
And don't embarrass us by not drinking. But, you know, just anyway,
And nuts. Advertising agencies, there are still some advertising agencies in London which have not only have bars in them, but free bars. The bar is free and it's open between 5 and 8 in the evening. Well,
it's a cool office thing. You know, we've got pool tables and dartboards and a beer fridge. And actually, we're upgrading. We've got beer on tap now because we're cool. That's what we do.
It's everywhere. And it's not just the workplace, you know. You've got me thinking now, Ben, we've had this conversation before. Crazy places where there shouldn't be a beer fridge or free alcohol. My favourite used to be, Tabin, sorry, we're going off on a bit of a tangent here. I would purposefully get the bus to my swanky hairdressers because I knew I could drink as much free wine as I wanted while I was getting my hair done. And if I was getting it coloured, I could be for 3 hours and I would leave steaming. Like literally steaming, and then get the bus home. It's the flipping hairdressers. Yeah. Like these days, I'm all for the coffee. But we've had this before. I swear somebody said that it was at a car wash once, Ben.
Yeah,
somebody
yeah,
went
yeah,
into a car yeah. wash. And there was
but people have got to drive away from the car wash.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. At children's play centres, I was upon this, admittedly, this was, I don't even think it was in the UK. Children's play centres. But it is just so... What's the word? It's just there at every single turn. So how then, you know, particularly in the, you know, the blue light services that we're talking about here, how do you try and educate people or show people that it doesn't have to be this way without finger wagging, without saying it's actually crap, you know, this drinking lark? Because if you'd have told me that, I don't work in the blue services, but as a drinker, if you'd have told me that 8 years ago, I'd have laughed in your face and gone, oh, bore off. I don't trust her. She doesn't drink and all that nonsense. And yet, obviously, on the other side of it now, I understand what sobriety is about. And as Ben will, you know, say regularly, it's not about what you're giving up. It's about everything you gain. But you are not aware of this until you stop and look back. And I think it is so hard sometimes to try and let people know that it's better. It's just so much better, particularly if you're trying to, you know, talk to people that are in incredibly stressful jobs in the blue light services.
Yeah, I think the reason we've done it around January is because Dry January is a thing, and it's really well known and it's gaining traction every year. So, and we're not saying give up alcohol forever, because that would just, people would just say, yeah, that's not happening. But just by saying, how about just take a break and see what you feel, how you might feel. This is just an experiment. So people join, and we can see from their testimonials that they join with a sort of like, well, I'll just take a look at this. But often there's a little seed of doubt there about where they've been thinking, oh, actually, I've had a few hangovers too many. I'm not feeling great. I put on a bit of weight. I keep meaning to go to the gym and I don't do it. My motivation is low. Da, da, da. I wonder if that might make a bit of a difference. So people come into it. And one of the words they use a lot in the testimonials is, I was a bit skeptical to begin with. And then I think they hear the things that we can tell them, our own, it's a really crap phrase, but isn't it? But our lived experiences, what's happened to us and what a difference it has made to us as individual coaches, as we all have our ordinary lives as well. So, oh yeah. And then people have their sort of their kind of beliefs, the truths, the things that they hold to be true about alcohol. And we just gradually work through them. So the big one, obviously, with the blue light services is it helps me unwind and relax after a tough shift. And then you just go through, literally through the biochemistry. What happens in the body when you drink alcohol? So it can't. It does. It feels like it relieves stress for 20 to 30 minutes. But after that, everything that happens in the body once the alcohol is in the bloodstream is doing the very opposite of that. Once people understand that, and then we give them some tools and tactics so that they can kind of put themselves in control over the subconscious, buy themselves the time to let the thinking part of the brain take over. And then they can, you know, we've got daily coaching calls, so they can come to a call and say, I was listening yesterday and I tried that and I found this a bit hard, or this kept coming up. So they get, there's literally daily coaching throughout the month of January. And then there's a Facebook group where they can post things, and Annie is really good. She's sort of on it and responding to people. And that Facebook group stays live, so there's ongoing support for them. And it's amazing. I don't know what the stats are, but there's been a very high engagement rate and a lot of people who've done the experiment and stayed alcohol free afterwards. Yeah, it's really heartwarming.
I love it. And I remember Annie telling us about this when it was starting off years ago. And it actually, what you were just saying then goes back to something you said right at the beginning of this episode about your story, where you said, I was never really not drinking, but also not really noticing that. Mm. And I think that is probably the most important thing that we can do. It's why we do this. You know, it's about kind of going, look, there is another way. You don't have to, just because everyone else is doing this, doesn't mean you have to. You might not have noticed that actually you had a couple of pints at lunchtime and then you came home, and you might not have noticed. You might just have done it. Actually, the important bit is to get people to just stop and think, isn't it? It's not about preaching. It's not about, it's just going, right, just, you know, we've done this. It's really benefited us. Like, is it a conscious thing or is it an unconscious thing? And I think that's one of the most important parts of all of this.
Yeah, I completely agree. And also the thing of, everybody, when they realize that, this relationship, you know, alcohol seems to have the upper hand in this relationship, what people want usually is to regain control, but to be able to just drink a bit. And when people sort of say, I just want to be able to moderate and have one or two glasses and stop there, I say, well, let's just see how it goes. Let's get you to, you know, and I always say this is an experiment. And in any scientific experiment, you have to have a control. You don't just experiment with the alcohol. You also need to have the control where you have a life without alcohol. If you just reduce a bit, you've got some very sort of fuzzy results there. So let's get you alcohol free for a period of time. 100 days is a good period because, you know, you're completely detoxified and some real benefits are beginning to show up then. And then you can decide whether or not you want to moderate. But by that stage, they've usually seen actually life's just so much better and sort of fallen out of love with booze so that they don't really want to go back to it.
Yeah, and I don't know if you agree with this, Tabin, but I think there are people in this world who are natural moderators and some people who aren't. I live with a natural moderator. My wife has always been a natural moderator. She'll open a bottle of wine, she'll pour a glass and she'll drink half of it and she'll leave the rest in the glass and then leave the bottle in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And that's not me. Just not. And I'm not a natural moderator with anything in my life. It's just, that's just the way it is. I was having a conversation with someone recently about this exact thing where I said quite strongly, you know, I realised, because there are bits of drinking culture that I do miss, Tabin. There are things that, you know, like, I don't live the same life now and my life is immeasurably better. There are some small parts of drinking culture that I look back on and it's not a rose-tinted glasses thing. There are some bits that I don't do anymore for very good reason that I do miss a little bit. But I made the kind of conscious choice. I can't pick and choose. I can't take those bits from drinking culture and this bit from alcohol-free culture and live this kind of amalgamation in the middle. It was one choice or the other choice for me. And it's just that simple. I'm really glad that I made the choice that I made to remove alcohol completely.
Yeah.
It continues to serve me well.
There's very little that I don't do. What I do tend to do is to leave parties when they've got really drunken. Kind of think, oh, they're all drunk and they won't, none of them will remember in the morning and I just want to get home to bed now. I have a really good time, but talking to people who are really drunk is just boring. So
yeah, the only kitchen you need to see at 2 a.m. is your own, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, all I need to see at 2 a.m. is my bed, you know.
Yeah, well, yes, quite.
Yeah. I was going to say, I've had about 5 hours sleep by that point. I haven't seen 2 a.m. for a very, very long time.
I mean, I still go to rugby. Most of the people there will have had a few pints. Just literally doesn't bother me. But if the people next to me were really, really drunk, I might shuffle along. But, you know, it really doesn't. Being with very drunk people is I wouldn't want. But other than that, I don't think it's really changed me, other than it's widened my life out. I've do so much more. I've got a much broader circle of friends and that sort of thing than I had before. Because I used to, like you were saying, Sharon, if somebody didn't drink, I thought, right, you're a weirdo. I'm not spending any time with you.
And now some of my best friends in the entire world are those sobers that I have scoffed at previously.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, me too. Yeah. And I've got friends all over the world, you know, fellow coaches who I've got to know really well, never met them, but know them really, really well, yeah, which is lovely. I'll go on a world tour one day and see more.
Oh, you should.
Yeah.
Just want to say we've had a message come into the chat box from Alex. Working in a blue light service, I often think there can be a tendency to think I should know better when people reflect on their own problems or challenges they might be having with alcohol. The work you are doing is very good for all agencies. You know, this I was going to ask you this. How have you been received? As somebody who worked in advertising, you know, you don't have a medical background. I think it's probably different with police and fire, but I think when it comes to the, I don't know what blue light service Alex works in, but you know, when it comes to medicine, how were you received by that crowd? Bearing in mind that there's a huge amount of knowledge about what alcohol is and what it does to the body and what it can cause within that community.
Yeah, I think never anything other than positively and warmly received, I would say. Well, obviously, we don't know what goes on behind closed doors. They may say, oh, she didn't know what she's talking about. But
I'm sure they didn't.
We're not giving medical advice. Mm. We're just saying, look, here are the facts. This stuff causes cancer, causes liver disease, causes cardiovascular problems, you know, contributes to dementia. These are sort of known facts. But I think the thing is that even if you know, I mean, both Charlie and Annie had problems with alcohol. They're both medics. So just because of the job you do and the knowledge you acquire in the course of that job still doesn't make you immune from alcohol.
No.
And, you know, we know that a disproportionate number of doctors actually have problems with alcohol because it's a highly stressful job. Mm. And so being intelligent and well-informed doesn't protect. Alcohol is very undiscriminating like that, you know.
We've got an amazing community member, and in fact she's been on this podcast. We call her Dr. Helen, like even as friends we just message hi Dr. Helen, hi Dr.
because that's her name. You mean not just Helen,
that we always give her the full title.
Yeah.
Full title every time.
Well, like Dr. Annie is watching this, I always refer to Dr. Annie as Dr. Annie.
And it wasn't until Helen joined our community many years sober, I'm going to say 6 or 7 years sober, that she felt able to tell people she was alcohol-free and sober because of the shame she felt in sobriety, never mind as a drinker, because of what she did. And safe to say, she's now loud and proud about the whole thing.
For medical journals.
Oh, she's amazing.
And, you know, photo right at the top. She's
amazing.
Great.
Sings about it. But it's interesting, isn't it, where you feel like, oh, God, you know, I should know better, the profession I'm in. But alcohol, it doesn't discriminate.
Yeah. And you could say that about the police as well, because they see firsthand some of the awful consequences of what happens when people are drunk, with, you know, car accidents and fights and violence and all rest of it. But, you know, police officers are human beings too.
We have got so much to talk about, and we've got literally about 2 minutes left. Tabin, it's been brilliant chatting to you. I've really enjoyed it.
I know we haven't got enough.
Can I sneak one more question in? Yeah.
Go on.
I am absolutely fascinated by this gut feeling. You know, that twice that you had. Have you ever had it again? And if you have and you don't want to share it, that's fine. But I think that is. It's almost kind of like, you know, bit kind of extraterrestrial.
Yeah,
kind of,
yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah. I had it once before and I ignored it. And that was a mistake. I could see that was a mistake. And I had plenty of time to reflect on it over the years to think, yeah, that was a really strong bit of intuition there. And you ignored it. And you're paying the price for it now, girl. So I had it really strongly over what was going on in my marriage, and I was 100% right, and it seemed kind of unlikely, but I just thought, I can't ignore this. So I asked John what was going on, and eventually he denied it at the time, but then eventually, and it wasn't just, you know, him having an affair with my best friend or anything like that. It was kind of quite deep. And I think it came from having had some therapy and starting to do some real personal development work, that I sort of started to listen, because it's basically your subconscious, you know, it's this very primal instinct and intuition. But we said, oh, well, that's an inconvenient truth, I'll ignore that. So I now don't. I use it a lot when I'm coaching. It's not such a deep thing, but I sometimes will say to ask somebody a really bizarre question. They say, how did you know that? Or how did you know that's what I was thinking about? And so that happens. And it also guides me, I think, in the when to do a bit of the tough love thing, which I do from time to time.
Tabin, thank you. If anybody wants to find out about your coaching, what you do, your work with the blue light experiment, where can they find further information? And of course, the book as well.
Yeah, it's all on my website, which is the usual HTTPS. Blah, blah, blah. It's winetowatercoaching.com. So winetowatercoaching.com. Yeah. Or actually, if you just Google Tabin Ahmed, because it's such a stupid name, I think it probably would take you there anyway.
Fabulous name.
Tabin Ahmed with the best name ever. Thank you so much for joining us on Over the Influence.
Oh, it's been brilliant. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed chatting.